Hey everyone, I'm Alicia Harris.
Hey, I'm Whitney White.
Hi, this is Larry Owens.
Hey, I'm Eric Lockley, and you're listening to the Call and Response Podcast.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Call and Response Podcast with Felicia Fitzpatrick. And if you're like me and you get nostalgic when you go home, you might be feeling a little sentimental right now as we come off the holidays. I know I am. Whenever I go home, I think about the people and the things that shaped me into the person I am today. So I think about, you know, high school boyfriends. I think about the middle school braces that I was so embarrassed by that I, you know, posed with that duck face for MySpace selfies. And I think about the dance classes I had in elementary school. And we did a tap dance to Janet Jackson's All Right from her Rhythm Nation album. And I remember I just loved that song, and I loved the dance and the music and the rhythm so much that at one point I was supposed to stand still during it, but I wanted to move so badly that I literally wiggled my feet, and my dance teacher kept saying, Felicia, stop moving. But I just, the joy was just, you know, pouring out of me. And I was thinking about this recently, and to no one's surprise, it's actually related to one of the events that Gold Star recommended for me this week. The musical salute to the soulful ladies of the 90s, Mary J. Blige, Janet Jackson, and Toni Braxton. I mean, like, for real, how do they do it? How do they know every time? Every week, they have something tailored just to me. But as we all know, that is just the beginning with Gold Star. They have affordable tickets to theater, concerts, comedy shows, and so much more. So download Gold Star, and let's make some memories, y'all. And you know what? I'm so hyped. I'm so thrilled. I'm so excited. I say it every week. I mean it every week because we have a lot of talented artists out here, y'all, that we get to talk to. And I'm so excited to introduce this week's guest. He's an award-winning actor, writer, producer, content creator. We love ourselves a multi-hyphenate on the podcast. You may have seen him in Luke Cage or hashtag date me, the OK Cupid experiment. Blacker, the list goes on, and we're gonna dive into all of it today. Y'all, it is Eric Lockley.
Hello, what's up? Hey. What's up?
The audience is saying hi as they're listening.
I'm sure.
I love the way we met.
Yes,
it was so. I feel like organic is a buzzword now, but we organically met after A Strange Loop,
mm-hmm.
which features two podcast alum. You guys, like, it's all interconnected.
Absolutely.
I love this. But because how do you know Larry?
So Larry and I's mothers worked in the same department or same office in Baltimore. So we're both from Baltimore.
Stop it.
Yeah. And our parents worked together.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
The roots ran deep.
Deep. Yeah. And wow. I think, oh gosh, I might be making all this up. I'm not, I promise. But I think he was in dance school with my brother, like a black owned
yes.
local community dance center, yeah,
yes.
for a period of time.
Oh my gosh,
yeah,
that's
so.
Amazing. I want to see those home videos.
Oh yes, there are plenty of home right. dance recitals on tape. Yeah, fun stuff.
That's amazing. That's a perfect segue because I love to start out these podcasts knowing how you got involved with performing arts. So it was in Baltimore.
Yes, like. Okay. Yes. That is a perfect segue.
Yes.
Because how I started was as a kid, I would always I would watch Michael Jackson, David Copperfield, and and like old episodes of I Love Lucy. Like those were things
okay.
that I would watch over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So there are tapes in my house, VHS, old school, of
right.
like recorded performances of MJ, of David Copperfield making things disappear, like all types of craziness. So I would go in front of whatever I could see, could get in front of and that reflected me and start dancing or start like trying to make magic tricks happen, which I,
yeah.
that was not really successful, but the dancing stuck.
Okay.
And so then my parents enrolled me in a dance classes mm-hmm. and also had me perform in malls. Like just, they
oh.
bring a little boombox and we'd sit in the center of the mall, like in the courtyard where people eat.
Right.
And I'd start dancing and
a little
hat would be out and my father would be over there like, yeah, boy. It was intense. But it was a lot of fun to get all that attention as
of
a 4-year old and have money to throw into the fountain,
mm-hmm.
you know, into the water fountain.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. So, okay. So your parents were supportive, first of
yes,
all.
Yes, they were very
like
supportive.
The arts.
Always, yeah.
What, did they grow up in the arts or they just knew it was something
They just knew it was something special. special, I think. You know, they weren't really artists. My mother would sing on the on the choir at church.
Oh, okay.
And my father would say, yeah, he's the best. He's a hype man. If there's ever been one, my father's a hype man. He will shout no matter who's around.
Yeah.
So they weren't artists really themselves, but I think when they kept seeing me dancing and watching these tapes over and over, they were like, I think there's a passion and talent for this.
Yeah. So I guess my second question that was popping up while you're telling that story was like, the mall is such an interesting place. So I'm thinking about, you know, when you go, like when you're in middle school for the first time by yourself, there's like all this like social performance attached to it. So when you were, I mean, as a 4-year-old, I'm sure you weren't aware of like social performance, but I mean, what did that experience mean to you as you were finding your way to like seriously studying, you know, performing arts?
Yeah. Well, I think what it rooted in me at a young age was that it's possible to be fruitful doing. It's possible that also creates fulfillment. Because not only did, at 4 years old, was I like, I love that I'm dancing and people are watching me. But I also was like, this is joy. Like, this is genuine joy.
Yeah.
And I think, for better or worse, certainly for better, but just to say it, for better or worse, as an adult, now I still have that hunger and that belief that I can be fulfilled doing something that brings me joy. Mm-hmm. Because as a kid, I was doing it and, quote unquote, making a little money. I mean, you know, people were throwing change in a hat. So I wasn't really making money.
Right.
But I saw the joy it gave other people, first and foremost.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is something that I want to be able to feel always.
Yeah.
And so I think having that support and being in the surroundings where people might have just been there to get, you know, to get things for the children
Sam
or whatever.
Goody.
Right, Sam, yes, about the newest CD or whatever. But yeah, they got a little joy from seeing me do what I love. So I believed in that from a very young age.
I like that too, because that's in your artist statement that I found on your website, which y'all need to go check out. It's popping over there. So I love the idea of joy with performing, because I think as people start to enter as a career, that can be lost.
Yeah.
So when did it click for you that it could be a career, that it was going to be your career?
Mm-hmm. I think I there was a period of time, I can be very nosy. I've said this publicly. Some friends are going to be like, ha, you can't take it back. But anyway, I can be a little bit nosy. And so as a kid, I was very nosy. And so I used to believe that I would be a spy.
Okay.
And that I'd be deep in espionage.
I like it.
Yeah. And so then I saw, this might have been middle school, I don't know, no one keep track. But I saw Mission Impossible with Tom Cruise.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know what would be better than being a spy? Acting like being a spy. You know, like, you know, I wouldn't have to really deal with that danger.
Right.
I wouldn't really have to, you know, sacrifice my actual existence, you know.
Right.
So at that point, I was like, you know, I think acting is actually what I want to do and want to focus on. And I've always been really into storytelling in all forms, but I think that was the moment where I was like, acting is what I really want to do, and I know that this is possible for me to be a performer and feel fulfilled and to have a career in it, because others do it, why not me?
Right.
You know what I mean? And
right.
I love this and have loved it since I was 2 years old.
Yeah. And dancing in malls.
Yes.
I love it. So then was that the moment, I mean, when you decided, okay, I want this to be my career path, like, how was the journey of finding your way to NYU for all of this, too?
Yeah. I loved New York. So I've got lots of stories. But when I was 7 years old, I performed at Amateur Night at the Apollo.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, I did.
Wow.
I did. Yeah. So that was really, really cool.
Yeah.
I was the most popular kid in elementary school, which was an achievement. like, not only did the teachers know my name, but the prince, like everybody, everybody was like, oh, you went to the Apollo. So I felt very, very cool. That lasted until the end of middle school.
Gotcha.
Well, until the beginning of middle school. Middle school, everything changed. But anyway, going back to the Apollo. The Apollo, that was amazing to be in Harlem, and to, especially at that time, the Apollo show was on, Showtime at the Apollo was on Every week, and so I would watch that and watch all the performers and celebrities be on that stage. So to be able to be on the same stage, yeah. to be able to rub the tree stump that so many people, including Michael Jackson, James Brown, like people that I admired, was amazing. So I knew at that point, like after I performed and I won three times, and like maybe
what?
As a kid made like $300
you
or something.
Slid that right in, okay,
yeah,
yes.
you know. And wow. then so from that time forward, I was enamored with New York.
Okay.
And was like, my dream school is NYU.
Yeah.
So then just put a lot of intentionality. I worked really hard in high school, and then came to visit and asked people what they thought. And so when I got it into NYU, I was like, well, then this is it. This is it. This is where I want to be. And there's no place like it. And I love it so much. There's just such rich culture here. And you can walk outside and you don't ever have to be bored. Like, there's really no excuse to be bored.
Right.
Because there's so much free entertainment in New York City. You walk out,
so true.
There's something to be entertained by.
It's
so
true.
I love it.
What was the art scene like in Baltimore, like you were saying, when you were like hustling in high school?
Yeah. That's a good question. And I say that because I was so focused on like my studies, so I don't really know what the art scene was like. I can say like we would go in high school, we would go see plays at Center Stage, and my mother had a subscription to Everyman Theater and Center Stage. So I would go to those theaters and see awesome work. And Arena Players, which is a small black-owned company, I worked at their summer camp and like helped them to train young black actors and actresses. So the art scene, at least then, I had access, which was great.
Yeah. That's really helpful when you're deciding like
absolutely.
Put your mind to it like that. So then I was so excited to learn about you studying both theater and Africana studies, because that's what I studied at UT. And obviously this podcast is all about that intersection. What was that experience like of fusing those two together in that intersection?
Yeah. It's interesting. I think it's actually threefold.
Yeah.
I think one part of it was my own interest in knowing more about the African diaspora, more specifically about my history and culture as an African American, and not really getting that much from my education initially, and being like, well, I'm in college now. I get to make the choice. I want to learn as much as possible about my people in the diaspora. So it was that. There was also, I studied abroad in South Africa, which I loved it. It's my favorite place in the world. I was there for 7 months and just got to get a sense of the similarities and yet differences between a black South African and a black African American, you know.
The classic black African American.
You know, them black African Americans.
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
So there was all of that. And I think being in a predominantly white institution, it also was important for me to invest in my people and feel really confident about me continuing to learn and delve into the stories of our people. And because that's what I was passionate about. And I think ultimately what it allows me to do and is to tell those stories as a storyteller, as a writer, as an actor, as a producer, is to just have more insight into the necessity of the stories, the richness, the complexity. And so I'm grateful that I did that. And it serves me. It continues to serve me.
Absolutely. I was going to say enrich your experience as an artist.
Yes.
Was there, because you said something interesting of like, how your former education, it hadn't necessarily been the focus, like Africana and African diaspora studies. Same, like hard cosine growing up in like the white Pacific Northwest. Was there a play because I'm thinking that A Raisin in the Sun inspired me, but also like I read Native Son. I was like, wow, I'm so fascinated by all of this. Was there a piece of literature or play that inspired you?
Ooh, what's funny that you said Native Son, because that is my favorite book still. It's so powerful. Native Son and Invisible Man, which I read both of them in high school, they really changed my life and allowed for me to really own my blackness in a more bold, ambitious way, and more unapologetic way.
Yeah.
So those are two pieces of literature. In terms of plays, I was in a production of The Color Museum, but The Color Museum is probably one of those plays that I read it and I was like, oh my gosh, this is everything I want from a play.
Yeah.
And there was humor, there was irony, there was drama, it was everything. Right. So that, yeah, those are some works that really inspired me.
It's powerful when you find that piece that, like you said, you feel unapologetic, mm-hmm. you know, in your identity and things like that. And so I wanted to talk about, like, the work that you have performed and also written. I know they run the gamut for the different projects you've worked on. But, like, Room Number 4 that you performed in, that was about different tropes that black actors have to play.
Mm-hmm.
Or The Last Laugh.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, after being inspired by these plays, how did that all inform you, your work?
Yeah.
Ooh, this is a loaded question, but let's see if we can break it down.
Well, the big thing, well, two things. I'll say in terms of how does it inform my work, one thing I want to encourage any listener out there that's an artist to do is continue to create work.
Yeah.
Because I think I've learned a lot about my work by just continuing to put stuff out there because I'm able to be like, oh, this is really what I'm passionate about, even if it's not explicit in the work. I'm like, oh, this is why that didn't work, because I'm not as passionate about that. But anyway, so what I learned or what inspired me in terms of things, for example, the Colored Museum, the way that it uses, I mean, essentially it's a parody, but so my solo show, Last Laugh, was a bit of a parody, a dark parody, where I got to play a Sammy Davis Jr. inspired character and a Step and Fetch It inspired character. And so with that, I knew it's called Last Laugh because it's supposed to be a comedy, but it gets very dark.
Sure.
And these are two performers that historically, like, I read biographies on Sammy Davis Jr. and a biography on Step and Fetch It, and both of them were aspiring for something to reach success. Mm-hmm. And like Sammy Davis Jr., so many people talk about his impressions, but ultimately he hoped that he could, I don't want to say be white, but he was trying to beat racism.
Crossover.
He was trying to, if he could impersonate this person, then maybe he could be seen as just a person, a human being, and not a black man. And so that aspiration influences how he was an entertainer and influences how he entertained. And with Step and Fetch It, it's like he played dumber than he actually was. He was the first black millionaire in Hollywood, and he was smart to a certain extent, but he played characters that don't that. And it's like, how does that affect you when you know that your performance is so separate from who you are, but that's ideally what's going to get you where you need to be? It's like, it's just so deep, and people continue to go through this today, you know?
Right.
The idea of performing blackness is something that consistently fascinates me, and I put it in many of the works that I write. Because Black in the Bubble, my quote-unquote affirmative action play, is about a black man who, on his first day at work, does not fill in his race in the paperwork, and the top folks at the office are freaking out because they need a black person. So they're like, oh, we need you to fill in the
quota.
Yeah, exactly. So there are just numbers of ridiculous attempts to get him to fill in the bubble.
Right.
And he has to kind of explain that, can't he just be?
Yeah.
So I love the idea of performing blackness and how it affects us as a culture.
So, okay, I have so many thoughts. I'm trying to figure out how to sort them out and ask them. So we'll just figure it out. One, there's a quote, and I've brought this up on the podcast before, from Basquiat, that's like, I'm not a black artist, I am an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, I get what he was saying of like, he doesn't want this qualifier, but I'm curious of what your thoughts are on that, because there are, like, you, of course, there's the whole like colorblind conversation and discussion, like you can't erase race. And I feel like these kinds of situations that you're bringing up in your work, like, yes, there may be crossover, but I'm curious on your thoughts on the quote itself.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not a black artist, I'm an artist.
Because you know what I'm saying? Like, I get, like, he doesn't want to qualify,
right.
Like, he is just an artist.
Right.
But, like, can't we also celebrate that he's a black artist that's thriving in a white supremacist patriarchal society?
Totally. I think, I wonder if Basquiat was around today, if he would say the same thing, or, you know, because I just think that it has become clearer and clearer that we must lean into our individuality and who we are and be purposeful about celebrating that as opposed to thinking that that's diminishing it. Mm-hmm. Because to me, I hear black artists and I hear so many excellent things that aren't qualified. They it doesn't suggest that, well, you got ahead because you were black, or it's right. Like you have done incredible work and you're it says excellence to me, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm proudly black and an artist, and I think that it's important to acknowledge that and celebrate it and not think that it diminishes the artistry at
yeah.
all.
Yeah. Yeah. These are not connected thoughts and questions, so I'm going to just ask them as they get to
Yeah,
my mind.
Yeah,
so
go ahead.
That. But then the other thing I was thinking when you were discussing those two projects, you read the biographies, or you like find your source of inspiration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then what is your process in terms of creating it into a show? Like, do you start with dialogue, or like, I just have this thought, I need to feel it out?
Uh-huh. Well, I will tell you this, and also a little bit of a plug. So I just did develop your own work workshop in the middle of December, and I'd done it at Cleveland Playhouse. I did it at Howard University. So I've done it some other places, but had never done it in New York City. And so I was like, let me offer this. Yeah. And so it's an examination of kind of my process a bit. It's condensed. It's 2 hours to like get you started on some piece that you're excited about. But for me, what's really important is first and foremost, picking something that you're passionate about and something that makes your blood boil, you know, like whether it's PETA, you know what I mean? Animal cruelty, whatever it is, like you've got to be passionate about it if you're expecting that you're going to write about it and potentially if it's a solo show, perform in it.
Right.
So I make sure that I'm passionate about something and then I go and kind of do the research. So that's part of reading the biography, is if it's something that's inspired by something that you can research.
Yeah.
And then it's just creating, like trying to be unapologetic about the amount and not saying, okay, it needs to be an hour, so that's going to be 22, whatever, you know, however many pages, not analyzing the how, but just creating and getting in the habit of creating and pushing yourself to like, okay, well, I'll write for however many hours today, however many minutes today, but just getting in the practice.
Right. And not censoring yourself.
Yeah, not censoring
right
yourself. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And starting to write and then understand, okay, these are the things I'm passionate about. This is how I'm talking about it. And then creating a but, if that makes sense. And by it's just, I know, create that but. But ensuring that within the story that you're telling, there is the other side of the coin.
Mm.
Because sometimes, you know, especially with solo show work, it can be, and I felt this, and, you know, and it was feelings, and it was feelings, and, oh, those feelings.
Right,
it's like,
right.
You gotta know, but what's the conflict? Like, what's the story you're telling, and what is the, this is important to me, but, you know what I mean? Like, that's really, you know, if you're talking about animal cruelty, it's like, yeah, but what happens when that dog that bit your mother?
Right.
You know what
I mean?
It's
right. Like so creating the stakes.
Creating the stakes. Yeah, really making it, if you're aiming to tell a story, let's have some stakes. So that's another big thing. Like, once I'm like, okay, this is what I'm passionate about, this is my lens on it, I want to be really clear on, well, how do I undermine that or make it more difficult for the characters to continue to have that stance, because that's engaging art.
Y'all are getting a free masterclass right now, I hope the listeners realize. I'm like taking notes in my head. And that's so funny, or it's not funny, but it's not surprising that you teach a workshop in this, because when I was looking at your website, reviewing all of these shows that you've done, I'm like, you make it look so easy. I mean this in the best way. You make it look so easy to create work. I'm like, I'm going to go write a solo show now. Like, look at Eric thriving, just doing the damn thing. Like, no excuses. He's out here just doing it. It's, and so with that, like, I guess
thank
the
you.
Question that,
because I'm like,
absolutely.
What?
No, for real. And I guess I'm wondering, was it a situation where you wanted to create this work and so then you became a producer, or were you already toying with the idea of being a producer and you're like, well, I'll just produce and get all the stuff produced?
it's interesting. I think about even going back to the dance school that I was a part of. So the dance school was, it was called DeVay's Christian School of Ballet and Tap.
Hey, hey.
And then it was black owned. It was owned by this wonderful, very funny, black woman and her two daughters. And they ran a business, you know what I mean? They were entrepreneurs.
Yes.
And so that I was raised seeing that.
Gotcha.
And so I think part of me, you know, unconsciously was like, this is what we do. You know what I mean? We want to see something, so we make it.
Right.
And then we say, hey, we made this thing. Y'all are welcome. Come on in. Come in.
Mm-hmm.
And we can thrive together. And so that's a part of why I started and was one of the founders of the Movement Theater Company.
Yes.
But that's also why I continue to produce things on my own, because I know that if I am providing a platform for people, including myself, then it's just, it's enriching all of us. It's enriching the community. So that's a quality that I've, a lesson I've held with me since I was a kid.
Yeah, I love that. Shout out to Baltimore.
Yeah.
Baltimore.
Like, just teaching the youth. And, okay, so I want to talk about the Movement Theater Company. I want to talk about Harlem 9.
Uh-huh.
How, walk us through the catalyst, the origin story of you and those two producing companies.
Okay, so the Movement Theater Company, we started, some of us were in school at NYU, and some of us had recently graduated, but it was all a group of NYU, either recent students or recent alum.
Yeah.
And we were at a Starbucks at Astor Place, and y'all know that one.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, that just recently had a wonderful renovation. much needed, though. So we were in there, and we were like, hey, we're frustrated by the industry. It feels like you either have to be gangster number three or ready to do August Wilson. And we're like, we all look way too young to be in any August Wilson piece right now.
Hey,
so we don't want to wait until we're, you know, 38 to get into theater.
Of course.
To have opportunities to be in theater. So what we found there was a lack of, especially at that time, was black. I'm saying black because most of us that were there were black, but there was Latinx as well. And what we were committed to was creating spaces, a space where people of color could come to tell contemporary stories.
Right.
Because that was the issue.
Yes.
We were finding that there was too often it felt like theaters were presenting historical dramas or dramas that were steeped in how hard it is to be black and how hard it is to be Latinx. You know,
the struggle.
It's a struggle. It's struggle, struggle, struggle. There was a very little joy and or acknowledgement of the complexity, the resilience, the happiness. And so so for the movement, we just wanted to tell contemporary stories and like tell the stories of people who were more than just survivors, but people that like to go out on Saturday and have a good time, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, so that was the genesis of that, and how initially we organized it was we like had a little writers group and we had dues.
Yes.
It was very like school club at first.
Right.
Like, y'all got your dues in? Okay, well, next week. You know what I mean? It was like, or else what?
You got a clipboard,
you
have the checklist.
Yeah, it was fun. But so that's initially how we started. And then, you know, it continued to grow and to form into more of a solid organization.
Yes.
And and then we learned by doing, as well as Art New York Alliance of Resident Theaters.
Yeah.
That was, we took workshops there. We became members there and took workshops, which were exponentially helpful in terms of us growing. And then for Harlem 9, which produces 48 Hours in .48 Hour Play Festival, we, Sandra Daly and Spencer Scott Barros, they had Liberation Theater Company, and they still have Liberation Theater Company, and they, especially Sandra, was like, I want to get all these black producers and creatives together, and we're going to sit and chat and figure some things out.
Yeah.
And so I think she did it for like 2 or 3 months where it was just people, let's just come to my place and I'll provide food and we'll talk. And then eventually, as the months continued and fewer people showed up, just because, you know, you're sustaining a commitment, it can be difficult.
Right.
We were like, all right, well, let's do something. And we were like, we don't want to just be a theater company. We don't want to do things that have already been done. And so initially we were like, well, what are different ideas that are out there? That was 24-hour plays. And then we jokingly were like, well, we black. what would the CPT, what would the CP time version of 24 hours be? And we were like, oh, yeah, we're going to need more time.
That's funny.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if that story's been told publicly before. But anyway.
That was good.
Yeah, you know. So we were like, you know, let's remix the 24 and make it 48.
That's funny.
And then it just was the first year we were so nervous about like, how are we going to do this? Is it going to work? Does it make sense? But it was magical, and it's amazing to see 30 artists, which is 6 directors, 6 playwrights, and 18 actors come together and create something together in 48 hours that then is performed. It's 6 short plays that are performed off book in front of a live audience one night only, and all in 48 hours. And it was amazing to see. And the community that it builds, it's incredible, because it's like going to a camp. You know what I mean? It's like going to camp. Those artists go to camp for that weekend, and then once it's over, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna miss you. I'll never forget you. And you can't, you know, this once in a, it only happens once. So
I was lucky enough to attend the 2019, was that in May?
It was in August,
I think it was in May. 2019 is a blur. The August 2019 in August. Okay. And I'm like, wow, last year was crazy. No, I was, you know, you invited me, and it was magical. It was like, I was excited just because you invited me, but I wasn't prepared with how compelling, how much it would resonate with me. Mm-hmm. I'll say it that way. Let me shout out the sound engineering, because that was Eric Lockley, and it was amazing. You did the playlist, right?
Yeah.
Like, the songs were hidden. They were. They really were. Before I let go at the end, I was like, I don't want to say I manifested it, but I was sitting there on this like, oh, before I let go, would be fun to do at the end of this. And then sure enough, you knew what, you read your audience so well.
And it's so funny just to hear you say like the transition music was really, it was hitting.
Yes.
Because it's funny, I think all of us, because Harlem 9 is actually 6 of us producers at this point. And I think we all have like little things that we're really proud of.
Yeah.
Little things that's like, that's my thing. So the transition music for 48 Hours in Harlem is my thing.
Okay,
and, like, and I'm like, every year I'm like, I'm going to plant, ooh, I know what song, and I like get really into it, so thank you.
Yes, your work does not go unnoticed.
Thank you.
It was just so, it's one of those things, you know, where they say like you think about something too much and it's like inorganic. Here I go with the word organic again, but like it was so visceral of just like these things that they were putting out. And York Walker's piece, I remember, hit me in my gut. I won't spoil it in case y'all get a chance to see it. But I mean, all of the plays, they just all had a special something that was like, just the fact that it had been done in 48 hours, I was so inspired.
Yeah.
I went to the early show, y'all, and then I immediately ran out, called our friend Jamichael, and was like, you have got to come see this. I will buy your ticket if I need to. Like, you've got to come see the 9:30 show, because it was just so inspiring and motivating and fueling. And yeah, so that's my rambling and gushing about that.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, it's so wonderful, because for us at Harlem 9, what we saw to do, what we continue to do, especially with 48 Hours in Harlem, is create a space for black artists to really delve into their individuality, but also through looking at the legacy of what's come before.
Right.
So part of the process, the 48 Hours process, is there's some inspirational material. So this year, it was all into Zake Shange works.
So
all the playwrights and the directors read 6 of her pieces, and then were led to write something completely different, new, and fresh. And so being able to say, hey, this is us looking at the past, but also creating a new legacy with these 30 black artists is really at the core of what we do. So it's so wonderful to hear that it's impactful.
It was. And I didn't plan for this podcast to be me just gushing about it, but since I have the floor right now, let me continue. It was so, you could feel the community roots of it too, mm-hmm. just even from like the pre-show. And when I say pre-show, I mean standing in the lobby and a guy came up to me and said, hey, I saw you were first on the waiting list. My friend's not here. Have their ticket. Mm. And the conversations we had when I sat down, it was even after, just, I'm just saying, like, you don't get that at a Broadway show. Mm. Like, no shade to Broadway, I love you. And there are nights where you see your friends there and it's great, but there is just something so like home about it and family, which I really loved. Anyway, and that transition music. So it was all really beautiful. I'm glad you brought up Intozaki Shange because I was curious, how do you guys choose the theme each time?
Yeah, it varies.
It varies.
Right. We're coming up on our 10 year. So this year, 2020, will be 48 Hours has been happening for 10 years.
Wow.
48 Hours and .. so we're like, oh gosh,
right?
what special can we do?
Yeah.
But initially, what it was our first year, we had 6 black plays, classic black plays that inspired.
Ooh, okay.
So that was initially. Then like after 5 years, we were like, oh, we need to switch this up because they're not even classic at this point. Unfortunately,
right.
You know, because the idea was like, oh, you get
which is telling.
I know it's crazy. So then we did like something where it was like African folk tales. Then we did 1 year we did James Baldwin and Sonia Sanchez written texts.
Yeah.
So we kind of switch it up every once in a while. So I don't even know what we're gonna do this year, but we'll keep you updated. Make sure you check out harlem9.org and stay up to date and see what we've done in the past because it's been 10 years. Crazy. And we also have 48 Hours in El Bronx, and which we do with Pergones Theater in the Bronx. And this past year in 2019, we did 48 Hours in Detroit, and we did 48 Hours at the National Black Theater Festival in Winston-Salem.
Yeah.
So we had 48 Hours was happening.
Y'all are all over the place in the best way.
Yeah, yeah.
And this year also featured podcast alum Miranda Heyman.
Yes, yeah.
Because we connected there, and I was like, you need me on my podcast. So, look, they, like, you get connected to the artistes.
Yes, for sure.
Speaking of podcast alum, though, Alicia Harris,
mm-hmm.
Whitney White.
Yes.
Who you are working with via the Movement Theater Company and What to Send Up When It Goes Down.
Yeah.
And it's just announced that it's coming back.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm so happy because I have not seen it yet.
Oh, I was going to ask you. I was gonna
I got to go.
Yeah.
So tell the good people about that show and y'all's involvement of producing it.
Yeah. Ooh. Well, this could be the whole podcast. For the Movement, this truly was such a blessing in a very specific time. And we are growing because of it. So we are so grateful to both Alicia and Whitney because this piece has been really, really special. Mm-hmm. And when we read Alicia's work, when we just read it, we were like, this is something special.
Wow.
To have a playwright who is so unquestionably, unapologetically about speaking to black people and advocating for black people, and a director who like is such a visionary,
mm-hmm.
and so also just as passionate about creating new and different spaces for black people. It's like the Movement was founded to be a movement, to be something larger than, you know, watching plays. None of the plays that we have done have been very traditional at all. Mm-hmm. Always huge cast. It's always wild things going on. This just came at a moment where we were like, yes, we can we can afford this to a certain extent. We're willing to stretch ourselves. We stretched ourselves like we have never stretched ourselves before to be able to do this and do it in a way that people are getting paid the most we had ever paid people. You know what I mean? So
right.
it was a big stretch for us.
Right.
But then to see that this stretch has resulted in a tour, and now we're at the Under the Radar Festival at the Public, and next we're going to be at Playwrights Horizons. It's like to see what happens when you really step out on faith, because that's really what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you heard the church come out. That's what, step out on faith. That's what it was. Favor. Anyway. gosh. But there was a lot of faith. There was a lot of like calling on the ancestors. There was a lot of ritual around this piece.
Yeah.
And like to see how it continues to thrive and create a healing experience for black people, because that's what's at the core of it, is creating healing and space and safe spaces for black people, has been amazing. What I'll say, because I don't want to talk too much about the piece without folks seeing it, but it is at the start of it, it starts in a separate space from where most of the ritual takes place, but it is clarified that this is first and foremost for black people. and you have to understand that before you walk into the space.
Yeah.
And I think creating that understanding before folks walk into the space allows for us to truly do something that is for Black people, by Black people, and because of Black people, and does not put any type of, isn't a platform for trauma porn, for, you know what I mean?
That's
because that's
the
problem. It's like too often there's trauma porn and there's reliving things that we don't need to relive without accountability. And this, what I think we are so proud of is that Alicia has written a piece that examines some of the challenges of being Black in an anti-Black society, but it doesn't say, and that's where you're stuck. And that's how we stay. Because no way. We are too powerful. And there's too much of a legacy of overcomers to leave people in a theater being like, and yeah, so that's just how we live and die. You know what I mean? It's like, no, this is how, like, we have done so much more than just be victims of a culture or be oppressed people. Like, we are so much more than that. And so,
No, for real.
So I'm so grateful to be a part of it and so excited for more people to and more communities and us as an organization being radical and having radical hospitality and ensuring that Black people have tickets. Like at this run at Under the Radar, we know that historically there are presenters and people from internationally who buy up these tickets. So we were like, hey, we have to make sure that not all the tickets are on sale via the public's website.
Right away,
because then certain people who are privileged to have access, whether that's money or if that's just knowledge or just time, they can swoop them up. So we made sure that a certain amount of tickets were given to organizations that were Black or that cater to Black audiences so that we get Black people in there. So, yeah.
Y'all are doing the work.
Thank
for real.
You.
And telling contemporary stories, like you said, you know, I feel like, one, you know, Black theater, Black performance, Black art is so rooted in ritual that, one, it's so exciting to see a work like that happen. But two, like you just said, it's like the trauma porn. And Jordan Cooper said this on the episode he was just on, of like explaining Black death or just like letting Black death hang right there on the stage without any medicine to heal. So I think that's so exciting and important and necessary work that you guys are doing.
Thank you.
Yeah. What was it like when it was down in D.C. versus the first one you guys had up here in New York?
Yeah. I think one of the funny things is in New York, when you do a piece and it's off-Broadway, then you typically have the off-Broadway audience. So, you know, you have people that are used to attending theater in New York.
Right.
And so there's a certain etiquette or expectation that it might be different. It might be weird. It might, you know, I think there's a readiness that's there. So when we went to D.C. and we partnered with Woolly Mammoth Theater to present it at Black Spaces. So we went to Howard University.
Okay.
We went to the Arc. We went to Duke. Duke Ellington High School of the Arts. And so, like, I saw it at the Arc, which is primarily Black space. And there was a senior group one of the times that I saw it. And the piece starts in a lobby where there are images of over 200 Black folks who have been killed due to racially motivated violence. And so that's where it starts. So there's not like sitting in the theater waiting to for the performance to start. It's like you're standing in a gallery, and this is what we want you to soak in before we begin the ritual. And so there was an announcement made before the actors were going to come out, and the announcement was, there's no reentry, so if you have to use the restroom, please use the restroom now. And this older Black lady, she said, they ain't gonna stop me if I gotta go. And I was like, oh my gosh. She went on. She said, who are they to tell me I can't? I'll leave if I have to, and y'all gonna let me back? Like, she was over it.
Letting you know.
She was letting, and I was like, you know, we respect our elders.
Right.
We admire our elders. But I was like, girl, why can't you just, you know, if you got to go to bathroom, go now,
right,
and then you won't have to be fussing. This is for you. You know what I mean?
But we're trying to take care of you.
Right, we're trying to take care of you. You can't tell her nothing. And so I loved, like, watching her during this because she was in it.
Was she?
Oh,
she didn't have to go to the bathroom.
She had to go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And if she did, she held it. And so I was like, so that, I think that was another thing.
Right.
In terms of being outside of the New York scene, was, like, just seeing people who hadn't experienced something like this that was, and still called it theater or still called it performance, you know, because it is, it certainly is a ritual at its core, but to attend the theater and have that expectation, especially in Black communities, that it's like, okay, well, I'm gonna sit here and I'm gonna clap at the end, I'm gonna feel good, whatever you're gonna feel, but then you're gonna clap at the end and that's it. No. This is much larger than that, and it's intentionally larger than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, I love that, like the engaging, you have to be present with it.
Yeah.
I'm curious too, when you were talking about creating Last Laugh or. You know, even with the creation of the Movement Company too, versus I know the other experience you've had with like hashtag date me, of telling specifically Black stories versus we'll call it color conscious casting, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even really know what my question is with that. I guess I'm just curious on your thoughts because, you know, I think it's great that you were in Date Me, which, by the way, y'all, was very funny. Like,
Thank you. I went
and I was like, I know I'm going to have a good time, but it was fucking hilarious.
Thank you, yeah.
Y'all were so funny. But something like that where it's like, you know, you are a person in the world and you are Black versus, you know, I guess these other works we're talking about where it's like a specific Black experience. And that's all I'm thinking about right now. I don't really have a question, but if you want to talk about it, I'm willing to listen.
Right. I think what I got from that statement slash question was all good. I think you were maybe curious about the experience of curating a intentionally Black space versus curating a space that is either where you either happen to be the only Black person and or is that, yeah, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll talk about that. It was interesting. In hashtag Date Me, I was the only Black person in the cast. And it was a very unique experience for me because as a creative, I have intentionally curated spaces that are intentional about being for people of color.
Right.
And so it's rare, honestly, that I go somewhere or that I'm a part of an experience where I'm the only Black person. Like, no.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that experience was really enlightening for me. And it required me to, in ways that I hadn't, speak up for people of color and speak out and speak up for queer people of color. And so it tested me, you know, in a really wonderful way because it's like, how do I have a theater company that focuses on people of color and I have the history of telling stories of Black people and queer people and, you know, and then I'm in a piece and I'm going to be silent when I don't see myself represented. And I was like, nah, I got questions. I have suggestions. I have, and it was tricky. And some of those moments, you know, that I suggested or that I thought about reached the stage, then we're cut. You know, it was interesting, but I'm very proud of myself for owning the fact that I couldn't be in that space and not say anything.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Or that. Yeah. Yeah. And I was honored that Robin Lynn Norris, who wrote hashtag Date Me, who was one of the writers, she was really open to listening to some of the suggestions,
and
that it was a space that was like hungry for that.
Mm-hmm.
But whether it was or not, I was going to say something because I was like, I can't.
Yeah.
I have to.
Were you scared at all in those moments to speak up?
I was. I mean, I'm in terms of speaking up in the moment, I'm a thinker.
Gotcha.
So I'm like, okay, I feel this thing. Let me think on how to say this best. You know what I mean? I'm not I don't initially like just snap, which is good. Or get out of bed, whatever. But I know myself well enough to know, okay, let me sit, think about what's the best way to pose this suggestion or this thought.
Right.
Or if I was asked, then I'd be like, okay, this is how I feel, you know?
Yeah.
But usually I sit on it and like think and like, okay. So it wasn't, it was a little scary.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little scary. But I felt like I have to.
Yeah.
If not me, you know what I mean? I also think about in situations like instead of say, why me, say, why not me? And if you're saying, why me, say, this is why. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
And this is what I'm going to do about it.
Right.
As opposed to why me, just sit and sit, weep, and just wallow in your thoughts, you know?
Well, Yeah, I mean, no, it's great to hear, and I'm projecting a little bit when I say this, because sometimes that conflict is hard.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You have to be the, I don't know, the word pioneer comes to mind, mm-hmm. of like, you know, you're the only person in the situation. Ooh, yeah. It's up to you. That's intimidating.
Yeah, yeah. So other things, I do so many things. But I say that because I was going to bring up another thing that could take us on a whole other topic. But I've done diversity and inclusion workshops.
Gotcha.
And so one of the things that, I'm trying to think of how not to take forever to explain this. But we go into spaces with the company I work for. We go into spaces, corporate spaces, educational spaces. And we're like, all right, these are some of the challenges being the only black person in the office or being one of three in the office. And then we may have a performative element where we perform something that could have happened that would have been uncomfortable. And then we're like, so does anyone want to talk about any of their experiences? Or we create the platform for them to speak up. But their reality is they have to every day walk into this space and try to figure out, can I do this today? And like I, as the person that's coming to do the work, you know, to give the workshop, I get to leave. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they don't want to speak up. And my feeling is like, this was your opportunity, you know, to say you don't like them asking you how you get your hair like that or whatever it is. You know
right?
what I mean?
No, for
like,
real, yeah.
This was your opportunity. But that same person might not feel, you know, brave enough because like you said, as a trailblazer, if you're the first one, then it can be very lonely.
Yes.
And it can be very difficult. And everybody's not up for that, you know? So it's hard. But I also think by talking about it, you discover that you're not alone. Because mm-hmm. that's a lot of why, you know, the feeling is that we're alone. But that's a lot of why sometimes we don't do things because we feel all alone and like, oh, I can't do this by myself.
Right.
So hopefully, you know, the more open we are about our challenges with that, the less alone someone feels so that they can face it, knowing that others have.
Right. And that's why, like, why not me?
Yeah, why
you
not
know?
Me?
Because, like, someone has to do it to open the doors for other people.
Yeah, yeah.
I had no idea that you did those workshops. Yeah. That could be a whole other podcast for
yes,
real, though.
Yes, it could.
I'm curious, like, have there been negative reactions during those workshops where you guys have to, like...
Yes. I'll tell you all about one.
You don't have to say their name.
I'm not going to say no name, no companies. But yeah, I was in one space. I'll say two things that happened.
Yes.
But so one place, I am a character that's really hungry to move up in the company and passionate and tries to be like, okay, well, here are things that I can do. And I wanted to talk to you about a promotion or like opportunities to be more active at work. And so someone, a white woman, was like, yeah, your character seems a bit passive aggressive. I was like, whoa. And so then the facilitator said, well, why do you feel that?
I'm tired.
Oop, I know, right? And so the facilitator said, well, why do you feel that about his character? And she was like, well, he just seems like he's not satisfied. Like he wants more. And in that moment, my mind said, oh, so black people are supposed to be happy with what they have. And
right.
I was like, this is probably, and this is in my mind. And I was like,
of course.
Yeah. I was like, so you just expect us to be mm-hmm. grateful for where we are
right.
and happy and not say anything and not question and not try to get more.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, this is really deep. You don't even realize what your perception of what a black person or maybe specifically a black man should, you know,
mm-hmm.
should just be grateful for what they have. And so so then the job of the facilitator is to kind of like try to navigate that conversation. So that was one thing. And then this was a sad moment where it's like internal racism is really challenging. But we were at a space and there was a guy who was Latinx and we were talking about race in the workplace and the workplace environment. And we asked them to talk about something that bothers them or challenges them.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke up and we were like, great, we're so excited.
Yeah.
And he goes, so forgive me, but you'll see why this is intentional. I'm going to do an accent, but it's intentional.
Okay.
He was like, you know, I have an accent and people make fun of me, but it's cool. You know, like
it's fine. I was like, no, it's not fine. That's why we're here.
Right.
And so he was like saying it's cool and it's not a big deal. Oh. And, you know, because that was, I guess, his experience or that's his safety. You know what I mean?
Right.
But it's like, no, this is the opportunity where you can say, and sometimes it bothers me. But we have been so conditioned to believe that we can't speak up or that speaking up means consequences that we are unprepared to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So this diversity work, I could talk forever.
I'm like, look, we'll see y'all next week for the next episode of the Diversity Inclusion Workshop. But like that, it's and not wanting to make other people uncomfortable, right, by saying this bothers me.
Yeah.
And having to do the whole education thing, right? Of like, okay, like... That's exhausting for people of color, any marginalized community.
Yeah,
but
it's
y'all are doing the Lord's work.
Mm.
And I mean, it's a good step, you know, that these companies, I guess, even want to have the workshops. But it's that shit is hard. I can't even, I'm like going through it right now.
I believe it. If you all could see her, if you all could see her eyes, she's like reliving certain moments. I can tell she's going through it.
Yeah,
but you know,
but I mean that's hugely important work, and you as a writer and as an actor, and your producer, content creator, Lens, like that's so necessary for approaching these situations like that, because you do have that empathy for people who like may not be right, but you're like, okay, let's at least open this up for discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
Which theater's the same way, though, you know? So what are the current projects that our listeners need to be looking out for? Give us some plugs. What are the
things?
Okay,
great. Absolutely. So I have a web series that I co-wrote and co-created with this wonderful fella. I don't know why I said that. Rhett Owen. It's called Blacker, and it's a web series that explores what happens when this white man gets a spell put on him that strangers see him as black. So suddenly his white privilege is gone. And I play the black version of the character and my co-creator plays the white version. And so it's about, he's like, what's going on here? So it's definitely a fish out of water, but also a dark comedy in terms of commentary about what happens when your privilege is stripped away and you're used to it.
What are the conversations you and your co-creator have about that?
Oh, that could be a whole podcast. But what's exciting is that we recently brought in Liz Morgan, who's an excellent writer, to we kind of outlined episodes and we realized we were both pretty busy. So she's written some episodes and she's a black woman.
That's awesome.
It's really wonderful to see kind of the outlines that we created were a vision, and to see her flesh it out is really exciting.
Yeah.
But our conversations really are, what I'm realizing is that our conversations are a lot about about.
We're in Canada now.
Perceptions of blackness and whiteness, you know what I mean? Like, because he asked, so what do you think? And rightfully so, like he's really actually genuinely curious. But then sometimes, and I'm like, so what do you think? And we can surprise each other.
Yeah.
And then when we surprise each other, you know, because he, there's a line in the first episode that he wrote that's like, you in danger, girl. And I think it's hilarious. I didn't even realize that was from Ghost. Like, I didn't realize. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm a bad black person. I didn't know it was from Ghost. But he was like, this has to be in it. He was excited about it. I was like, what?
Interesting.
So we can surprise each other with what our either lack of cultural knowledge or expectations around, like, certain things. Because there's a moment in the first episode that I didn't like.
Oh.
And I keep saying, well, let's try it out. And it's there. And but it's like you're navigating that is interesting.
It's like compromise, like a
compromise. Yeah, and also it's really
whose idea was it? Was it yours or was it his?
It was initially his idea.
Okay.
And then Harrison David Rivers, who's one of his friends and a wonderful playwright that I know, was like, you should talk to Eric. And I was like, yeah. And then I heard about the idea. I was like, this is the stuff I love.
Yeah.
I love comedy to make social commentary.
Right.
And so it like it worked out. So then we just were like, all right, let's where do we see this going? And it's and it's so all this is to say, you can see the first two episodes on blackertheseries.com. And we're going to be shooting more episodes in 2020, which will they're going to be longer because our first few episodes are like 7 to 10 minutes, I think. And I think we're going to be creating longer episodes, and we want to do big things with it because it's a really fun, crazy idea, but we can say a lot with it. So I'm
absolutely
excited.
Yeah. I love this, like, this laughing or like comedy for social commentary is it works, and it's like super interesting. It's an interesting lens to take. Yes, for real. No, you always got so much going on, which is so exciting. Like we were talking about, you are going to be Icarus Jones for the Drama League's Director Fest in The Sporting Life of Icarus Jones, playing January 24th and 25th. But I mean, like, what else? What else you got going on?
I do musical improv. Yeah.
Of course.
So I'm with this group called Blank. We do Blank the Musical. And we get audience suggestions, and then we make an hour-long musical based on audience suggestions, and we improv it all. It's crazy and a lot of fun.
What?
So that's very freestyle, Love Supreme, which I saw yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I loved it.
Oh, my gosh.
But, yeah, so we do that, and we'll have, there's going to be two shows every month. So in February, we're starting, so I'll post about it, and hopefully folks can come check it out. It's a lot of fun.
That's it. Also reminds me of like Whose Line Is It Anyway? The best parts of it, you know.
Wayne Brady, I got to meet him. I mean, I've met him multiple times, but he gave me his email address.
And
I've emailed him. But anyway, and my father says keep emailing him. My father's like, you go, boy.
Exactly.
He's like, you go, boy. Email him. Email him again. Squeaky wheel. He literally says squeaky wheel. Whatever. He's like, did you email
already? Oh,
he's wonderful and hilarious. But yeah. The penultimate hype man.
Y'all, we gotta, I mean, I have plans now to go see Blank the Musical, just because, like, even with hashtag date me, like, I'm saying, y'all, Eric was so funny. It was, I just laughed and laughed more than I was expected, to be honest. I was like, wow, like, not from you, I'm sorry, from the whole experience, I mean, but like, I was like, I'm not sure how funny Eric is. No, I knew you were gonna be funny. I just, like, the whole thing, I was like, this is well done. I'm gonna stop rambling. So, okay, like Blank the Musical, comedy chops, as we discussed with hashtag date me too. And you said earlier you love I Love Lucy.
Yes.
So I want to hear about all of your improv comedy skills. Like, I think that's so impressive. So I'm just like, just tell me about it.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think for sure watching I Love Lucy, which I just think is such classic sitcom/physical comedy.
Yeah.
Watching that, but then also being raised on Cosby Show, Family Matters, Sister, you know, having these opportunities to see black people and living color, even though my parents were kind of, you know, they were a little like, you can't be watching. They were a little too, you know. Anyway, but I did eventually see it. I saw it. So ha ha, parents. Yeah, real funny. Anyway, so I think, you know, being around all that as a kid definitely influenced me. And then as an adult, like, I am so passionate. I've been so fortunate to have so much joy in my life. Mm-hmm. And so I love that comedy gives people of many different lifestyles an opportunity to laugh.
Yeah.
And so utilizing that to for social commentary, I think, is really important. But in general, like, I want to be able to bring a joyous energy to people, you know? And sometimes that's by making them laugh or by making them a little uncomfortable and laugh, you know, but I love laughter as a tool to work towards change. And so that is a big part of my purpose and who I bring into a room. But definitely when I'm telling the story, like, that's the story I want to tell.
Yes. And it just brings me back to baby Eric being like, I loved the joy that I got from dancing and performing and singing at the mall.
Yes.
Oh, y'all, I love it. So, like, but for real, you're so busy doing so many great things, which is inspiring. Let me be clear. But there's you've done so many projects. Like, when I was researching you on your website, you know, you had all of these different stage shows, but you also had The Jump. Tell me about The Jump, which was screen work. Sorry, everybody, to make that clear, from your theater work. So how did that happen?
Okay.
How do you ever sleep? Like, these are the questions I have.
I try to sleep. I do. Yeah. Years ago, I would have been like, I can sleep when I'm dead, but, you know, it's kind of important.
Right.
I want to sustain and
a little bit,
you know, have my cheeks not at the bottom of my chin. Anyway, so I do sleep sometimes. But The Jump was really inspired by me pushing past fear. That's really what's at the core of it. Like, there's a quote that I love that's, behind every fear is a wish.
I'm gonna journal about that one tonight, y'all.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So I wrote it. I love your expression. I wish you could see how you were just like, yeah, I'm really going to.
Yeah, that spoke to me.
It's real. Yeah. And so I was like, what are some things I'm afraid of? And I was like, let me push past that. So one of the things that before I wrote The Jump was I really was looking at my fear of the water, which is, that's could be a whole story. But basically, I can get into pools. I can go into the ocean, but I get a lot of anxiousness. I used to get a lot of anxiety around it.
Yeah.
And I didn't know why. And then I went deep and discovered why. And I wrote a film about it. Here you go. Go see The Jump. It's available on Amazon Prime. It's on Amazon.com. So you can check it out. But it's really at the core. It's about this young black boy and how the magic of the water was something that inspired him as a kid. But as he grew up and faced the real world and was ultimately bullied at a pool, it kind of takes that magic away. And it's about how does he rediscover that magic as an adult. And so for the piece, I learned how to swim because that was going to be my way of pushing past the fear. So I learned how to swim in order to make the film. And that's why I made it.
I'm so sorry, but you just say this casually like, oh, I won 3 times at the Apollo when I was a kid. I made a film. What? Like, how did you just decide, okay, like, I'm going to make this film? Like, how does it go from, okay, I'm going to just make this film to it being on Amazon motherfucking Prime?
Well, you know, the first thing I had to figure out a story that I wanted to tell. Once I figured that out, wrote it and allowed myself to be imperfect and, you know, and allowed it to be messy and still shared it with folks that I trusted and said, hey, can you give me feedback? And some of the feedback was like, yeah. And some of the feedback, I was like, really? And some of the feedback I had to, you know, because I think that's the messiness of the process that we sometimes don't acknowledge is like the fear of sharing this something that is so precious to you.
For real.
So I was, you know, you got to get past that and share it so that you can get feedback and receive feedback and make it better. Or make it more in line with what you intended. And then I partnered with the director. His name is Jamal Hodge, and we had worked on a project before. And I actually asked him his opinion of it, and he was like, I'd love to direct it. And so we had discussions, intentional discussions about, well, what's your vision versus my vision, and can they work? And they did. And then he helped me in terms of making sure, you know, knowing what equipment, because there was some stuff that I didn't have the experience to know.
Sure.
And then we made it, and it was scary, and there were kids, and there was water, and there was nearly drowning, and there was, you know, just all these types of things.
Dang.
It was crazy, but it was like, that was my goal, was to make this film and learn how to swim, and I did it. And like, that's sometimes you do things because you want to know that you can do it, you know, and you have to, and you have to push past all the anxiety, all the fear, all the maybe it's not going to work, to be like, okay, yeah, I'm going to stick with it because I can do this and I'm determined.
That is empowering and inspiring as hell. I love that. And I was curious too, so when you were giving out your draft for feedback, like how did you comb through the stuff that didn't necessarily align with what your vision was? Like, how do you separate that feedback that you didn't really need or want?
I think ultimately all of the feedback that I got was probably, most of it was helpful, but I think what I determined to be helpful or not in line with my vision really had to do with what is the story I'm trying to tell. I think sometimes, especially, for writers, we have their messages, their themes, their, you know, things we want to touch on. There can be a lot that we're that we think we want to say, or we're trying to fit into a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, you have to say, what is the story I'm telling? What is the beginning, middle, and end?
Damn.
And how do I make that as clear as possible? And trust that if I want to make implications about, you know, lack of sensitivity to race in a specific community, I don't know, you know, trust that the specifics will be heightened by you being specific about the story you're trying to tell.
Totally.
You know, the things that you're passionate, because for example, when we did the film festival circuit, there were people who, seeing this movie that's about this young black boy and his experience with the water, which is exclusively kind of being in it, there were people that still connected that to water fountains saying mm-hmm. colored only or mm-hmm. white only, and having that as an experience of this is my relationship to water, because I grew up in a time where the water fountains had colored only or white right. only. And right. so people were able, and those are things that I thought about that I was like, how do I make sure that it spans the legacy and speaks to all, you know, but my specificity within the story
made that happen anyway.
Made it happen anyway. So I think that's one of the big things to lean into and trust in.
Y'all, for real, this is a master class. I love this. I'm inspired. I'm like, okay, I gotta go write.
Okay, so then where can people follow you on social media so they can keep up with your journey and all your exciting projects?
Absolutely. I am Eric Lockley. It's iamericlockley.com is the website. Eric is spelled with a C.
That's good. That's easier. Eric is spelled with a C. Yeah, I like that.
Y'all can figure out Lockley.
Well, we'll tag him in the social post so y'all see it there too. Okay, so the final two questions to wrap up the podcast. But like for real, I'm like, we could do like multiple segments with you and all the hats you wear, because you are doing the damn thing. If you could recommend a piece of Black art, whether that be a theater piece, a musical album, a TV show, a book. Oh, yeah. Look, he's looking up recommendations right now, y'all. What would it be?
Oh, okay.
Take a moment.
Okay.
Take
you know moment. what's really powerful? At this point, I've experienced it at three museums.
Okay.
It's by Arthur Jaffa. So the piece of art is called Love is the Message, the Message is Death. Okay. And it is a video, it's a video installation that utilizes footage that's gone viral, everything from footage that's gone viral to images of MLK to, it is amazing. Like Michael Jackson, random people on the street. It's just, it spans a certain type of Black history that is so powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like 12 minutes long, but it is underscored by Ultralight Beam by Kanye West.
Yeah.
And that song feels alien. It feels like outer space. Mm-hmm. And the way that Arthur Jaffa utilizes the imagery to suggest, like when I walked away from it, I was like, we are alien. Like our Blackness is something otherworldly. Wow. Like we are, like like everything from, you know, he utilizes footage of traditional tribes in Africa dancing to watching people do the Harlem Shake in Harlem. And it's like, just to look at like the culture that we've created, we are otherworldly.
Yeah.
And it so affected me, especially as an art piece, to just, you know, be walking around thinking I know what to expect from a gallery. And then walking into this, it like really affected me. So you all should look up Arthur Jaffa.
That sounds moving as hell.
Yeah, it was really moving.
Wow.
Yeah.
Shout out to Arthur Jaffa. Yeah, so listeners, look that up.
Look it up.
And then on that note, if you could give a shout out to a fellow Black artist, who would it be?
Okay.
I know you're like very well connected, so you got a lot of people shout out. So if you need to do a top three, top five, top... But this is like, this is not exclusive. This is uplifting.
Uplifting.
This is giving some love. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is gonna be hard.
I'm
gonna say some people's
say some names.
I'm just gonna do it. I'm gonna be like that person that Price is Right while the wheel is spinning. You trying to say all that stuff? I'm gonna try to get it all out real fast. So all of my fellow producing artistic leaders at the Movement Theater Company, Taylor Reynolds, David Mendez, well, Deidre Harrington, and and Ryan Dobrin. Wow, I'm actually acting like there's a clock. Anyway, so all my fellow producing artistic leaders, as well as my producers with Harlem Nine, Jonathan McCrory, Brian Glover, Spencer Scott Barrows, Sandra Daly, and Garlia Jones, I have to shout them out because in terms of building community, they have been the people that I've built the most community with. Yeah. And I'm so proud of how we all have our individual careers, but also collectively come together.
Yeah.
So that's all of them.
I love it.
And
though.
Then I got to shout out Astronomy Club because they got a Netflix show that's out and y'all should watch it. That's it was the first black group, which is sad to say, that had a mod night at UCB. All you UCB or improv people probably know what that means. Uh-huh. But anyway, but now they have their own Netflix show that is black as fuck and beautiful and very funny. So Astronomy Club. And then I'm also finally shout out two last people, Trevor Hayes, who I was his mentor for his independent project at NYU, and he has since graduated and continues to like create his own path as an artist, and I'm really proud of him.
Very cool.
And finally, Dallas Rico, who is now in LA, and he is a writer who writes about nerdy queer black people and like it's beautiful and it is so bold and brave, and we need more stories that are like that.
Absolutely.
And so yeah, that's those are all of my shout outs for now, and
amazing.
I want to say so many more
y'all
people.
Please know if you know Eric, he loves you and gives you a shout
exactly.
out.
Exactly,
that's a hard question. Okay,
I do. And my brother Brett, like, so you know, okay, I'm gonna stop. I love y'all.
He loves all y'all, his tribe, his family.
Yes, I do.
Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you, Felicia.
This was lovely.
Yeah.
This has been a long time coming.
It has. You know? And you learned so much about like what you do and why you do when you have conversations like this. So thank you for creating this platform. And I know it's so healing and encouraging for so many people. So thank you.
Oh my God. Of course. No, it's my honor, my privilege. So that... You're the best. I love you. Thanks. Thank you. Until next time, y'all.